I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. We have a two-part show today. Actually, it's multi-party because we have a lot of issues to talk about. The first part of our program this afternoon, we'll be speaking with a senior investigative reporter for Politico and looking at a number of things that are happening. The House Intelligence Committee having hearings today. John Brennan, the former CIA chief, had some interesting things to say for the first time that he became concerned during last year's election there might be ties between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. Our guest this hour wrote a very interesting piece in Politico, Russia Meeting, and he's talking about the May 10 meeting that Donald Trump had with the Russian ambassador and the Russian Foreign Service director in the Oval Office, in which he talked about Russia and James Comey. And our guest writes that the new special counsel investigation into possible collusion between associates of Trump and Russia is just getting started. But the boast to Russian officials at that meeting about why he fired FBI Director James Comey will almost certainly trigger a more immediate and potentially perilous, he writes, legal development. We will talk about that. We will talk about the story from the Washington Post yesterday, President Trump asking two top intelligence officials to deny the existence of any evidence of collusion between his campaign and Russia. Both of the intelligence officials are testifying before lawmakers on Tuesday. So there's a lot here to talk about. And then later in the hour, we will be discussing President Trump's trip to Saudi Arabia and also to Israel. Josh Meyer, senior investigative reporter at Politico, reports on national global security issues, spent 20 years at the LA Times reporting on security and terrorism, and is a former director of the Medill National Security Journalism Initiative at Northwestern University. Josh, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Oh, there's just so much going on, Josh. It's hard to keep track of it. But let's center on that meeting on May 10th when Donald Trump is meeting with these Russian officials, including the ambassador. Your headline of your story just a couple days ago, that this meeting revelation could trigger obstruction investigation. How so?
Thanks for having me again.
Yes, of course.
This story sort of evolved from conversations I had with people, within the government. And, we'd already had Jim Comey's notes becoming public of meetings that he had with President Trump. We had Trump himself telling NBC News, that he fired Comey. He mentioned that in the same breath as the Russia investigation. But in this case, it seems like it's taken it to a different level. What happened was people that are former agents and prosecutors told me that, what Trump allegedly told the Russian foreign minister and the Russian ambassador in the Oval Office could trigger a obstruction of justice investigation into the underlying investigation of collusion, mostly because it goes to his intent. And basically what Trump did say, according to the news reports at the time, was that he just fired the head of the FBI. He was a real nut job. But then he went on to say, I faced great pressure because of Russia. That's taken off. And then a pause, and he said, I'm not under investigation. So The whole point of obstruction of justice charges is that it goes to intent. You have to be actually intending to derail or stop a government proceeding or investigation. And so that's what they believe this if true, suggests.
Mm-hmm. And then you compile that with yesterday's Washington Post story that looked at Donald Trump telling two senior people in national intelligence to back off on the investigation.
Right. So things do not look great for the Trump administration on this front. We are now hearing reports that they are interviewing candidates for a legal team. That, of course, does not mean that they did anything wrong or that they even think they might have done something wrong, but just that this is progressing pretty quickly. And I think the point that I was trying to make in my story, talking to people, in government, is that the underlying investigation into possible collusion between associates of Trump and Russia is just getting started. That could take years to resolve. It's going to be a very detailed probe, especially when you have former FBI Director Robert Mueller at the helm. He's very, very details-oriented. But the obstruction of justice investigation could move very, very quickly. When they have reason to believe that obstruction occurred, they move to secure the evidence very quickly. They would probably interview people, all of the people in the room. They would try to get notes from everybody in attendance. And in this case, also, if you remember, according to the New York Times that broke the story, there was somebody in that room taking notes about this, and those notes were used to create an official memorandum that was circulated about the conversation. Mm.
So those are official White House document, you call it.
Right. And, the Trump administration, Sean Spicer, they have not denied that. Neither did Rex Tillerson. But they're just trying to sort of, recast it as him trying to get leverage against the Russians. But that, according to my sources, doesn't change the overall picture that once the, FBI and the special counsel know of the existence of these materials, they're going to want to get them and get them very quickly.
And they get them, let's say they get them very quickly. It shows there may be obstruction of justice. Then what?
Excuse me? I'm sorry?
Then what happens if they find that there has been obstruction of justice? They believe.
Yes. Very good follow-up question. We don't know. I mean, you're getting into sort of uncharted territory here. I mean, I talked to some former prosecutors, obstruction of justice specialists, and one thing that they've said is that, the founding fathers, they left it unclear, whether or not you could actually charge the president of the United States with criminal acts. And one of the people I talked to said that, that has to this day still not been resolved. Legal scholars remain divided over whether a president can be charged. They can be charged civilly. They can be impeached, of course. But we can't be sure about that. If somebody who is impervious to political pressure and really is guided by sort of an inner compass that they want to do the right thing, I think it's fairly unanimous that Robert Mueller is that kind of person. So, again, I'm not trying to prejudge this, but, it's possible that criminal charges ultimately could be filed over an obstruction of justice a case long before the underlying investigation even gets really ramped up.
Oh, that's interesting. And I'm thinking about that underlying investigation that's going on. We've heard that it could take a long time. It's all over the world. It's in Russia. It's in Cyprus. It's here and there. It's everywhere. But considering how fast the news is moving on this, do you think anybody's going to sit still for a couple years to find out what the truth is here? Don't you think it'll come to us faster than that?
I don't think they have a choice in terms of sitting still. It depends on who you're talking about, whether you're talking about people, the public or lawmakers on Capitol Hill or the FBI, the Justice Department. One of my colleagues broke a story today about how the Federal Elections Commission is also moving to launch some sort of investigation. So, these things do take a long time. I mean, a lot of the time they're done in secrecy, so people aren't really aware of all of the work that's being done in these, but oftentimes people are interviewed several times. I mean, documents were reviewed. There's subpoenas issued. People are interviewed sort of more informally, and then they sort of proceed to the targets of the investigation, which are the people that are actually suspected of being engaging in illegal activity. One thing that's very unique about this case, I think, is that you're talking about some criminal violations that are very, very rarely charged. We're talking, violations of the Logan Act, which is interfering as a private citizen with the workings of government, which might have been the case or is alleged to have possibly been the case with the Trump administration during the transition, negotiating if they were with Russia over a possible dropping of sanctions and so forth. But even the counterintelligence aspect of this, the espionage charges, if warranted, or even the financial alleged financial violations, all of that is very, very complicated. They can't just show up in Russia and start interviewing people. You need legal clearance. There's things called letters rogatory, which are, sort of written requests for that kind of thing that often go back and forth for years before any action is taken. So, we're sort of in a wait-and-see mode to see what happens.
Whatever happened with a British intelligence agent who had collected that dossier that he turned over to the FBI? Is he still around?
Christopher Steele, yes.
Yeah.
He was ducking for cover. I don't know if he's ever come up from that, but I think it's safe to say that he's keeping a very low profile. One thing that I think is interesting to note about that is that over time, a lot of the allegations that he made in his dossier, which initially were sort of dismissed out of hand as being ridiculous, at least by the Trump administration, some of those allegations have been verified, including by the FBI. So, I think that there's a lot to that document. If you've read it several times, like I have, or many times, there is a lot of very interesting fodder in there. There's some things that are more outlandish, but I think there's some things in there that the FBI has been looking at very carefully. And if you remember, they brought him on reportedly to be a consultant of sorts in the case, however informally so. And they did present that dossier or a summary of it in the briefing to President Trump. So they believe there's some smoke there.
Yeah. We have time for a couple phone calls. If you'd like to join us, Josh Meyer is our guest. We're getting an update on the latest news when it comes to the investigation of possible coordination or collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Josh Meyer is a senior investigative reporter at Politico who's been covering this very closely. Our number is 800-486-8655. Call quickly, if you would, please. Richard Burr, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has said that he's going to take a further step, I don't know what those could be, to make Michael Flynn comply with the subpoena to turn over a lot of documents. He's also said that Flynn could be held in contempt of court. Is there anything that they can do to make Flynn turn over whatever he's got?
I think that the Congress has a limited more limited certainly than the FBI and the Justice Department do in that regard. I think that they can hold him in contempt of Congress, which is different, but in order to really hold him in contempt of court, the Justice Department has to get engaged, and so does the FBI. And my understanding is that they're operating on parallel tracks here. So the subpoenas, Flynn has also been subpoenaed, as far as we can tell, by the Justice Department and the FBI, too. So if he doesn't want to comply with those, you're looking at possible jail time, I think, as an end result. But there are serious consequences, even if it's, withholding from Congress.
He's probably holding a lot of information, don't you think, Jack?
Well, I think he is. I mean, I think one of the questions that we've been trying to wrestle with is, if he does take the Fifth, for instance, is this with regard to his lobbying efforts on the part of Turkey? One of my political colleagues did a very in-depth report about how some of these Turkish organizations that he was representing or affiliated with actually had some deep connections to Russia. So there's some questions about whether they were actually front organizations for Russia, whether Flynn knew that or not. Covering for something deeper. I mean, as the national security advisor for the Trump administration, as one person put it to me, he knows where all the bodies are buried. Mm. And we don't know what those bodies are or, why they were buried. But whatever it is that they are concerned about, if they are concerned, he would probably know a lot of detail about it.
Yeah. Are there recordings of everything that's going on in the Oval Office? Do we know?
That's a very, very good question. We're trying to figure that out. President Trump, as everybody knows now, did hint at that, or more than hint at that, when he tweeted to Director Comey, former Director Comey. He said, he better hope that there aren't tape recordings of our meetings. And having known Jim Comey for 20 years, as I have, I do know that he takes meticulous notes. And my understanding is that Comey is really looking forward to, there being recordings, because I think he believes that they would prove his side of the story, and he also has the notes to back that up. But also just by saying that, I think the president, as I noted in my story, really is opening himself up for a subpoena or a demand for the tapes or for some kind of certification that they don't exist. So I think we're headed for another showdown on that as well.
Mm. So if the FBI said, Mr. President, we have to interview in regard to many of these matters, would the president have to say, okay?
Well, I think that's one of the areas where we're in some sort of uncharted waters. It depends on, what kind of legal team he's constructing. I am certain, and so are people of the Justice Department, that he would challenge that. But ultimately, it is something that if you are the target of an investigation or somebody that the Justice Department wants to question, you are supposed to submit to that. I quoted somebody in my story who's a Justice Department official who said, and I know that the Justice Department and the FBI feels very strongly about this, but this official says the essence of our criminal justice system is that nobody is above the law. The fact that it allegedly occurred in the White House and that it may have involved the President of the United States is ultimately irrelevant in the analysis and in how we do our jobs. Mm-hmm. So they certainly believe that they should be able to question the President, and that would be the the expected end result of an investigation like this.
So do you get a sense, even though the president is out of the country, that everything is kind of ramping up here? We're getting more subpoenas. We're getting a lot of investigation. We're getting testimony. We're certainly getting story after story from, this is quite a time for journalism, from major places like Politico and the New York Times and Washington Post advancing this story, it seems like, every day.
Indeed. We're hoping for a day off. I'm really looking forward to this upcoming 3-day weekend, although I probably jinxed myself just by saying that. But yes, I mean, that is certainly the sense that we're getting, is that this is ramping up. One of the big questions is whether it was ramping up before Comey was fired, whether he knew it was ramping up, and whether the president knew it was ramping up, and whether that had anything to do with his decision to fire the FBI director. And, you know, there's a real sense, I think, among journalists, and certainly the sources that are providing us with information, I wouldn't call them all leaks by any stretch, but there's a lot of concern that just what the president himself has said to the Russians, to Jim Comey, according to his notes to NBC and other media outlets, that if you just take the president at his word, some form of obstruction might have occurred. So it seems like it's something that they have no choice but to investigate.
Yeah. When is Comey testifying now? Is it? It was supposed to be Wednesday. It's not anymore?
It's a bit fluid. I think it's going to be after Memorial Day weekend. But I think things are changing. One thing that's very interesting to note is that there were a lot of other people scheduled to be testifying, and that they're sort of dropping like flies. And the question is whether that's just because they're trying to defer, including Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general. The question is whether that is just in deference to the new special counsel, or, as some people have been speculating, because they believe that he is homing in on some sort of obstruction case and that they don't want to say anything. So we'll see. Stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned. I hope you get the weekend off, Josh.
Thanks.
I don't think you're going to, Josh.
I won't.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Josh Meyer, senior investigative reporter at Politico, and he wrote a piece that caught our attention. He's up on all that's happening, and there's a lot going on this week. He thought it might be quiet because the president is out of the country, but that certainly is not the case. Josh wrote a very interesting piece about the meeting that the president had with the ambassador and Foreign Secretary from Russia in the Oval Office on May 10, the day after he had fired Comey, and the information that he gave the Russians that there could be obstruction of justice and people could be looking at that now. And then we have the Washington Post report yesterday that the president spoke to two senior people in the intelligence community and asked them to hold off on their investigation of possible collusion. So, there's a lot going on. Well, we're going to continue this hour. We have a lot going on, certainly in the world, and we're going to be looking at the president's trip to the Mideast. He had a shift in U.S. policy toward the Mideast. We're going to be talking about the Sunnis and the Shias and Saudi Arabia and Iran and Israel and the Palestinians and all of that with a professor of history at UCLA. All of that is coming up. And we always welcome you to, even though we're switching topics, if you want to comment on the investigation, that would be fine. If you would like to talk about the president's foreign trip, that's what's on the table right now. And the number is 800-486-8655. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we like to read your messages on all topics all of the time. So you can write messages there. This is the Ideas Network. Joining us now is Professor James Gelvin, professor of history at UCLA, expert on the social, cultural, and political history of the modern Middle East. He's a member of the UCLA International Institute and has done research on Greater Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of The Modern Middle East, A History, and The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Professor Gelvin, thank you so much for being with us. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Did you think that the president's trip, particularly to Saudi Arabia, his speeches, et cetera, indicated a real change of policy, that the United States is now aligning itself with the Sunnis in the Arab world?
Absolutely. It's a 180-degree shift that's taken place. When Obama came into office, he felt that the United States had expended a great deal of time and energy on the Middle East, and that it's going to be Asia that was going to be the focus of history in the 21st century. So he did everything possible to lighten America's footprint in that area. One of the things that he did, for example, was he tried to bring Iran into the state system again, diplomatic system, in order so that they wouldn't be on the outside acting as a spoiler. He also attempted to end immediately the Israel-Palestine conflict. That went nowhere, and to stay out of Syria. Now what we are seeing is Trump is literally looking at every policy that Obama had and doing deliberately the opposite. He, for example, crossed that when Syria crossed the red line again with chemical weapons. He did not balk at getting involved in launching missiles against Syria. And you know, this new idea of joining with Saudi Arabia and joining in Saudi Arabia's actual paranoia against the Iranians is something that's going to actually polarize the region and go in the opposite direction of calming the waters there.
Hmm. Why? Why is he doing this? Why align yourself with the Saudis?
Well, there's undoubtedly multiple reasons to do that. As I said, he does seem to be making policy based upon the idea of looking what Obama did and doing the opposite. Obama had a very prickly relationship with the Saudis and with the Israelis as well. But what he doesn't appear to understand is the way in which Obama was actually trying to go back in time to the policy that won for America the Cold War in the Middle East. And that policy was offshore balancing. In other words, you get others to do your work for you. Now, we've gotten out of the habit of doing that. We invaded Iraq, Operation Desert Storm, for example. The United States did all the heavy lifting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what Obama wanted to do was to make sure that others did the heavy lifting for us. What Trump is saying at the present time is, no, we'll go back into the Middle East. We'll get more involved in, for example, the war in Yemen or the war in Syria.
Well, if he's going there, please explain this to me, because he's talking about, after blasting Islam extensively when he was on the campaign trail, now he's talking about how it's one of the world's great faiths and how the war against extremism, he doesn't tell us how it can be won, but he wants all of the nations to drive these extremists out. And yet you have, it's my understanding, and you know a lot about this, you've got fundamentalist Sunni orthodoxy that has, as New York Times editorial said today, has given legitimacy to Saudi Arabia's royal family and has inspired ISIS and most other regional terrorist groups, that it's coming from a philosophy within the very country that you're aligning yourself with. And some are saying that you're seeing more extremism coming from Sunni nations than from Shia nations. So how do you try to drive out terrorism when you got that going on inside the country?
Pretty tricky, isn't it?
Yes.
It's not going to be possible. Look, I read a statistic the other day, which is actually quite interesting. From 1918 to 1989, the Soviet Union spent approximately $7 billion in spreading communist propaganda. From its inception to the present day, the inception of Saudi Arabia to the present day, the Saudis have spent approximately $100 billion spreading Wahhabi doctrine.
Wow.
Wahhabism is the extremist ideology that the royal house in Saudi Arabia believes in. You're absolutely right that, you know, we are aligning ourselves with an extraordinarily hostile power. When I say hostile power, I mean hostile to American ideals.
So we sell them $110 billion, and it's not just Republicans who have done this. We still align themselves and give them a whole lot of weapons. Why are we doing that? Everybody does that.
Well, we number one, they've asked for it, and it's certainly not going to cool down the region. But on the other hand, people forget that Obama himself made deals for about $115 billion.
Right.
Worth of weaponry. I mean, this is something that the United States does. It keeps, you know, Raytheon and General Dynamics. It keeps their assembly lines going. It helps employment in the United States. And, of course, the Saudis have an insatiable appetite for weapons. Now, the problem is, of course, that the Saudis are using many of those weapons in extraordinarily destructive ways. For example, this war in Yemen, where it's taken to bombing civilians, blockading ports so that food doesn't get in. And now famine is a real problem in Yemen.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Syria and the Iranians' alliance with Assad and also with Russia and Saudi Arabia's. Where are they in that whole mess that keeps going on? And could they be of any help in some way?
No. The problem with Saudi Arabia is that they are funding parts of the opposition. That's the good news. The bad news is the parts of the opposition they are funding and backing are people who we don't want to see in power. For example, one of the strongest organizations in the opposition is Ahrar al-Sham, the Free Men of Syria. What this organization stands for is it wants to turn Syria into an Islamic state after Assad is overthrown. Mm. This is hardly the Free Syrian Army, the army that was made of pharmacists and lawyers and carpenters, as Obama famously put it. This is basically a cure that's worse than the disease.
Hmm. And when we kept hearing reports of Iran in the second term, the election over the weekend for a moderate, a relative moderate, Hassan Rouhani, is really Iran more moderate, and I'm not even sure what that term means in a place like in Iran or Saudi Arabia, is there a way that would be beneficial for us to more closely align ourselves with Iran and a moderate leader there than Saudi Arabia, or does it not make any difference?
First of all, the Iranian regime is extraordinarily opaque. We don't really know at any given moment where the power actually lies. It appears to be a triumvirate at this point. It appears to be Rouhani and his people on the one hand, and Khamenei, the Ayatollah, on the other hand, and finally the army, which usually blocks alongside Khamenei. That's what's going on. Now, I think anybody who says, let's ditch the Saudis and go for the Iranians as our friends in the Middle East is very, very naive. But the thing that's important, I think, and what Obama was attempting to do is to recognize the fact that at the height of the Cold War, there was détente between the United States and the Soviet Union. The idea behind détente is not that we're going to become best buddies, but the idea behind détente is we're going to cool things off a little bit, you know, lower the pressure just a bit. And I think that the United States was well on its way to achieving a form of détente with the Iranians. In other words, they're not going to do stuff that we like all the time. We're not going to do stuff that they like all the time. But on the other hand, we will be talking to them, and we will be attempting to lower the pressure. The problem that we have now is we've taken one side. We've taken the Saudi side, and we've pretty much polarized, as I said, the situation even worse than it had been before. When I said before that the Saudis were paranoid, that's exactly what's going on. The Saudis blame, for example, the uprising in Bahrain on the Iranians, and the Bahraini government set up a commission of its own and said there was no Iranian involvement. They blame the Iranians for the Houthi rebellion in Yemen. Mm-hmm. The Houthi rebellion started in 2002. Mm-hmm. So there's this incredible paranoia on the part of the Saudis. And now that we are aiding and abetting that paranoia, things are going to get very dangerous in the Middle East.
Yeah. Let's go back some years to this horrible event that happened in the United States. 9/11 happened. 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. Have we ever gotten to the bottom of that? Aren't we a little worried about Saudi Arabia because of that very serious, horrific thing that happened to us?
We should be. I mean, the problem is that Saudi Arabia is a state that we have been aligned with since Franklin Roosevelt, as a matter of fact. It's very important in terms of not American oil or oil for America, but it's very important in stabilizing the international economy in terms of oil production, you know, and shipments to Europe and Japan and various other places as well. So it's very important in that sense, and that's what the United States has overlooked. It's mere peccadilloes, like, for example, you know, financing Osama bin Laden during the Afghanistan invasion by the Soviet Union, or, for example, the fact that so many of the hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. This is not an alliance that we really need at the present time. Mm-hmm. We don't need it in terms of the fact that oil is fairly plentiful globally, and certainly for the United States. And Saudi Arabia is making a great deal of mischief wherever it treads.
Mm-hmm. And before we move into Israel and the Palestinians, what is this Center for Global Extremism, and what was this orb thing that was going on with hands on that? It was kind of a weird picture.
It was. It looked like some ripping out of King Arthur's court.
It did, really. You're right.
The center is actually interesting. The center, of course, is to coordinate, theoretically, is to coordinate policies to fight extremism. In actuality, what it is, it's a Sunni alliance against Iran.
That's
fundamentally what it is.
Really?
But in a way, it is fighting extremism, because the money that Saudi Arabia could have been given to Ahrar al-Sham and other radical groups in Syria, it is instead investing in the foundation of this center. So, there's a slight lessening of Saudi financial aid to these groups as they build this thing.
Hmm. So the president was off then spending the last 2 days in Israel, telling Israelis and Palestinians today that he knows that they are eager to reach a peace agreement and that he is committed to helping them make a deal. I'm not sure what kind of deal he has in mind. Can this president do anything that has been virtually impossible to achieve for so many administrations?
No. The short answer is just no. I mean, frankly, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, is eager for some deal, something that he could bring home to the Palestinians, and something of a legacy. He's very old right now. He's ailing. And so he will not be Palestinian president very much longer. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you have the Israelis who don't want a deal at all. And it's actually very interesting. You know, Trump goes to Israel and says, hey, look, you know, you have these Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf countries, and so on and so forth. If you make peace with the Palestinians, you know, you can actually join in with them on this fight against Iran. And the Israelis say, why do we have to make peace in order to do that? If they want our help, they should just come to our help. And, of course, that help undoubtedly is going on right now just under the surface.
Well, let's welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. This part of the show, we are focusing on the president's trip to Saudi Arabia and to Israel today. And welcome your calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Mary Rose in Westfield is our first caller for you. Hi, Mary Rose.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, like, why does President Trump throw women's and girls' rights, under the bus in Saudi Arabia and complains about children being killed by others?
There's two answers to that. First of all, the answer is that he said in his speech he's not going to lecture people anymore on human rights, period. And I think that that's wrong, and I think that's also very, very dangerous. The other thing that's interesting is the way you phrased your question, I thought was quite interesting. You know, his concern about children and the poison gas, for example, in Syria. And the story has it that he took a look at these children and he was so moved that he decided to bomb Syria because of the poison gas used. Well, here's a statistic for you. 1 million of the Syrian refugees are children under the age of 11. Mm-hmm. Where's his heart in that?
Hmm. And what was the outcome? These things happen, and then we just forget about them. The huge mother of all bombs we dropped on Afghanistan, the amount of money we spend on the bombing the airfield in Syria, did it make a difference?
No. I mean, maybe Bashar al-Assad is not going to use poison gas again, but certainly he's not going to stop using barrel bombs and employing the Russian, extraordinarily vicious Russian air campaign that's hollowed out whole cities. So that really had very little effect on the outcome of the war. I mean, the thing is that what your listeners really have to understand is that for all intents and purposes, the war is over, that the Assad regime has defeated, as well as it can, the opposition. This means not that there's going to be peace. This means that there's going to be low-intensity conflict between Assad and the opposition, probably for years and years and years to come. Mm-hmm. So that a UN diplomat, Lakhdar Brahimi, once said that the end game in Syria is going to be Somalization. In other words, Syria will become like Somalia. It'll print postage stamps, it'll have currency, it'll have its permanent representative of the United Nations. If it wants to, it can send a team to the Olympics. But it will not have a government that will rule as well as reign over the entirety of its territory.
Oh, that's fascinating. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that the war is essentially over.
Yes, the Russian air campaign certainly turned the tide on that one.
Yeah.
And it's at this point, the government is in a stronger position than it's been actually in years. As a matter of fact, in the summer of 2016, it was losing the war because of new tactics and an infusion of aid from the United States and the Gulf. But then all of a sudden, with the plea to Putin to send in more support for the regime, it's turned the tide. And so at this point, what we can expect to see is a continuation of the Syrian civil war for years to come, but the government will always remain there. And if there are negotiations that will take place in the future, there'll be the terms of surrender of the opposition and not anything else.
Hmm. Let's go to Jody in Downing. Hello, Jody.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to bring up when Trump went to Saudi Arabia, in his speech he made reference twice to the trade that they had negotiated and agreed upon,
mm-hmm.
which is arms. They're selling arms. Our president is over in Saudi Arabia representing arms companies and arms business to Saudi Arabia. That just really, really is disconcerting to me. And I'm curious, is that disconcerting to anybody else? And is this typical?
Well, it's also infrastructure. Wasn't there a big part of this that the Saudis were investing a huge amount of money in American infrastructure?
Yeah, there's two things, two parts of that question. There's the arms and the infrastructure and whether it's normal or not. Do you remember when Sisi overthrew the Muslim Brotherhood government in a coup d'etat? And there was this big brouhaha about why doesn't the United States call it a coup d'etat, which it really was. And the reason for that was because the United States still wants to continue to pump in weapons into Egypt as well. The way it works with Egypt, the way it works with Saudi Arabia is we don't give them money to buy weapons. We give them a shopping list. They give us back that shopping list, and then what we do is we keep the assembly line, as I said, at General Dynamics and Raytheon, these various other places. We keep it humming. And it's helpful in terms of domestic politics. So, for example, there was right before a congressional election, that was when the United States decided not to call Sisi on his coup d'etat. So, I mean, we have to keep that very much in mind. Now, in terms of the infrastructural development, that's also very interesting because, you know, they were talking about the strategic vision 2030 that the Saudis are doing. And that's basically to try to turn Saudi Arabia into a free market economy by investing in infrastructure, by, you know, building factories and what have you. Ain't going to work. Ain't going to work at all. They've been down that path before. They've tried it. Fundamentally, you have a population that is living on the dole, that all the heavy lifting literally is done by mainly South Asians, and that you don't have the sort of capabilities in terms of things like education and other things for Saudis to begin to move into a free market economy. You know, you ask a college professor, what is the most important thing about a college education? And the professor usually says to teach critical thinking. That's the last thing the Saudis want their population to do.
Right, yes.
Thinking.
Interesting point. Let's go to Muhammad in Madison. Hi, Muhammad.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
It might be obvious in some respect that I'm a Muslim. And no disrespect to your guest, but I'm hearing him, you know, regurgitate this narrative about what we as Muslims call the Saudi myth. I mean, Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, the ISIL, these people are not representative of this so-called Wahhabism. That ideology came out of Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood. Hassan al-Banna, the founder, Sayyid Qutb, their supreme martyr. And I'm amazed that a man who is so educated that he keeps his narrative going. Saudi Arabia, you know, Osama bin Laden left Saudi Arabia, you know, because he was against the government. As for Donald Trump being there, he's just taking a page page from the Bushes. Do you remember Bandar Bush, the Saudi representative that they, you know, brought into their... They made a lot of money off the Saudis. That's what the United States has always saw Saudi Arabia, regardless of its human rights, regardless of how it deals with women, money.
Yeah, so, Muhammad, I'm getting a little confused here. You're saying that Wahhabism is not practiced in Saudi Arabia?
First of all, the term Wahhabi comes from Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. He certainly is someone who is influenced the government from King Abdulaziz all the way back to then. They were
right.
That's where he took up the philosophy. But the ideology that is doing terrorism around the world is not out of Saudi Arabia. It's out of Egypt.
What about the hijackers? What about September 11 hijackers?
Well, where those guys came from is during the Afghan War, when the United States and the Saudi government and the intelligence agency of Pakistan were helping to defeat the Russians and breaking up the Soviet Union. We bragged about that. Those are individuals who were sitting around Saudi Arabia, and they went over to Afghanistan and learn how to perform terrorist acts and create bombs and fight what they call jihad.
Yeah. I have also heard from people, and our guest is an esteemed professor. I am not going to downgrade in any way what he has to say, but I've heard from many others on this program, too, Professor Galvin, that Saudi Arabia has really given money to terrorists, that they pay them off to keep them from coming to their back door. Is that all a lot of hooey?
Well, there's no links, actually, between the government itself acting as a government
and
terrorists. There's a lot of links between individual Saudis, individual Kuwaitis, individual Qataris, and various terrorist organizations. I didn't mean to say that all Wahhabis are terrorists, but Wahhabism is a gateway drug for terrorism. There's no doubt about it. In places like Indonesia and Malaysia, where there's a very different style of Islam, that is popular. It pretty much has crowded out, or is now in the process of crowding out, these other styles of Islam. The Muslim Brotherhood is not necessarily a single entity, first of all, and certainly participated in elections, and you might want to think of it as a reformist organization. They ruled Syria, they ruled Egypt, they ruled it badly. But they ruled Egypt, and in the same way, they were part of the first government of Tunisia after the uprising, and they actually did quite a good job. And when, for example, there was a threat of an Egyptian-style coup or counter-revolution, they stepped down, and free elections were held again. And also underneath this particular Muslim Brotherhood, the Tunisians promulgated the most liberal constitution in Tunisia, in Arab history, actually. Mm. One that doesn't give equality to women, it gives parity to women in government functions. So if you have 50 representatives, 25 have to be women.
Interesting. Yeah. Let's take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the president's trip, and we've been concentrating on Saudi Arabia, but feel free to bring us into Israel as well. The president, of course, on a two-day trip in Israel yesterday and today, and before that over the weekend in Saudi Arabia. So we're talking about all that has happened since he touched down in Saudi Arabia, and welcoming your phone calls. Muhammad, thank you for yours. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and we're on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is Professor James Galvin, professor of history at UCLA. He has done research on Greater Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories, is author of The Modern Middle East, A History and the Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Next caller is Robert in De Pere. Hello, Robert.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm actually a professor of Middle East history at St. Norbert College.
Oh.
I know Jim Galvin's work very well, and in fact, I've exchanged a number of emails with him over the years, so I have no bones to pick with him. I have no arguments to make. More a question, I suppose. I have spent a fair amount of time in Saudi Arabia in recent years, and my impression is that the country is moving towards I won't say a more liberalizing direction because I think that's the wrong term to use, but they certainly are aware of the need to change in some fairly fundamental ways. And I don't know if Professor Galvin is aware of this or thought about this or has a reaction. I can, I guess, cite two things. One, the fact that the so-called morals police, the Mutawa, who have wielded a lot of power in the past, have been stripped of a lot of their authority. I've actually spent time talking to them in recent years, and they're quite open about the fact that they can do little more than observe what's going on. They don't have powers to detain or arrest or anything like that anymore. Secondly, the fact that the younger generation, which in Saudi Arabia as elsewhere in the Middle East is the largest demographic, they're pretty open in the way they talk about the country and its problems. And like young people everywhere, they're completely hooked in on social media and fairly Western in their outlook. And I get the sense from talking to Saudis that the man who may be the next king, we don't know, and I'm guessing it is the deputy crown prince, Mohammed ibn Salman, is aware of this, and that a younger leadership is going to come aboard soon and try to move the country, but slowly, in that kind of, I guess, what we would call more liberalizing direction. I don't know if Professor Galvin has any thoughts on that.
And Robert, what's your last name so we can book you for a future show?
My last name is Kramer, Robert Kramer. I'm a professor at St. Norbert College.
Thanks, Robert. James?
Well, as far as, you know, I mean, I agree with almost everything the professor said, but I don't think that the pace of change is good enough. I don't think that the attempt to resolve the economic issues are going to succeed. I don't look at that as at all possible. And when you look at it, the largest demographic throughout the Middle East that is unemployed are new entrants into the job market and people who tried to enter in previous years. As far as liberalization of attitudes in Saudi Arabia, it's the same thing in Iran. You see this throughout the region as well. It certainly is taking place. The problem is whether or not the population is moving way ahead of the government and whether or not the government will respond to this. Now, you have a government where the king is actually also the prime minister. And under those circumstances, there is no reason for the government to move in any direction. You have a state which always ranks among the worst in terms of governance by the economists' rankings. So I don't see any future for this. We've been down this road before, any future for a reform effort coming from the top. We've been down this road before. This was the George W. Bush plan to sort of like slightly nudge, various monarchs and presidents in a certain direction. And then those monarchs and presidents will say, hey, you know, we have a peace a treaty with Israel. Hey, we're helping you out on the global war on terrorism. Hey, we're keeping a limit on oil prices. And the United States always backs down. So top-down approaches don't work. We've seen now that this bottom-up revolution didn't really work either. I think what we have to look towards is a long haul. In other words, taking over by liberal ideas, taking over institutions slowly, and that's the way we're going to get a bottom-up transformation of the Middle East.
Mm. Well, thank you very much, Professor Galvin, for being with us. You were just a really good guest, and thank you for all of the information. We'll be in touch again, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
All right. Thank you. Professor James Galvin, he's a professor of history at UCLA. His books are The Modern Middle East, A History and the Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Tomorrow, after 1 o'clock, we're just going to leave Earth for a while. I love doing shows on this kind of stuff, but tomorrow we'll talk about, remember this show, remember this star about a year ago that has this strange light pattern, and a lot of very learned astronomers are saying that, there's a chance that this could be an ancient civilization that's causing this light thing to be happening. So we'll talk to scientists because they're seeing it again. That's why we want to do the show. They've been seeing it again. So we're going to talk about that. And then after 2 o'clock tomorrow, conspiracy theories have become mainstream on both sides of the aisle. We'll talk to a reporter who followed the 24-hour conspiracy news cycle. Thanks so much to Colleen Henry and to Gretchen Brown for producing this hour. Multifaceted hour it was. Thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for your calls. Thanks for your interest. Thank you for listening. We'll be with you tomorrow.